That is Justice Bill Meyer. To my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and I'm Bonnie Sutterth. Would the clerk please call the case?
The court will now call Glenn Coleman versus the state of Texas. May peace the court. Mr. Adam L. Arrington will argue for the appellant. Mr. Matthew Whitten will argue for the state.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This is a fairly simple possession case on the facts. Our client was convicted of possessing a controlled substance, namely methamphetamine, and sentenced to 99 years in prison. There were some factual disputes at trial, but basically the detective on the case, Craig Fitzgerald, testified that he had received a tip from a confidential informant that our client was in possession of a quantity of methamphetamines, and he went to a soup kitchen that was located at a church in Benton to confront appellant, and the exact nature of the interaction between the detective and appellant was contested at trial. But as reflected in our brief, three of the four issues we've raised on appeal have to do with the confidential informant and the failure to disclose that identity, and specifically the effort to obtain disclosure about the informant's criminal history. Now, it appears from the record that throughout this case, the only person, that is to say, neither of the parties were privy to the CI's identity. The state stated on the record at trial, or at least one of the prosecutors did, that he did not know the name of the confidential informant. And there is a sealed record of an in-camera hearing that the judge conducted with the detective. The attorneys were not present at that hearing. It appears that, and in that hearing, the detective was not asked to disclose, and he did not disclose the CI's identity.
What would have happened if this had been an anonymous tipster instead?
Well, Your Honor, then
they couldn't disclose.
Right. They couldn't disclose. You're right. If it was an anonymous tipster, then 508 wouldn't apply because they wouldn't know that information. So, but in this case, we do know that the detective knew the confidential informant's identity, and under Rule 508, it is our contention that, one, that appellant met the showing under 508. He made a plausible showing that the disclosure of the confidential informant's identity may be helpful to a fair determination of guilt or innocence.
How was that? Tell me specifically, because I am having trouble trying to figure out how that is.
Well, basically, Your Honor, because this informant pretty much, by the detective's own testimony, set this whole chain of events in motion that led to appellant being apprehended with the methamphetamines, it was important for the appellant, the defense, to be able to find out that person's identity, one, to determine what exactly she knew, because apparently, from the record, it appears that she was the only one, the CI, that is the only one who knew that appellant was knowingly in possession of methamphetamines. Two,
but methamphetamines were found, if you believe the police officer. So doesn't it really come down to a credibility determination as to whether or not you believe it was planted or it wasn't? There were drugs there.
Yes, that.
And so whether the confidential informant did it for bad reasons or for good reasons or whatever the reasons were for that, this, or it was based on bad information or good information, drugs manifested themselves.
Yes.
And then it's up to the fact finder to decide whether they believe that they were planted or they believe that he had them on his person and he voluntarily put it on the hood of the car, wherever he put it.
Right, and we're saying that the confidential informant could have provided testimony to help the jury make a fair determination, could have provided material evidence that was necessary to a fair determination of that credibility. It also, it's not just whether or not the informant's tip turned out to be good. And this is where I think both the state, both at trial and on appeal, and even the trial court, based on her statements on the record, are missing a critical point. This doesn't, they keep saying that the credibility of the informant is not an issue, for the jury at least, not a fact issue for the jury. But it doesn't just go to the credibility of the informant, it goes to the credibility of the detective. For example, as we said in our brief, the jury, in assessing the detective's credibility, could have found it helpful to determine who is this person who he's been relying on, what is her background. And I'm getting into our third issue now. Obviously, the first and second issues deal with the disclosure of the confidential informant's identity. But the third issue, having to deal with the trial court's untimely allowance of the defense to cross-examine Detective Fitzgerald with the informant's, with his statements made under oath, we had three separate inconsistent statements from the detective. He stated in the in-camera hearing, when asked if the informant has a criminal history, unequivocally he said, she does. Then at trial, in front of the jury, he testified, I don't recall whether they have a criminal history. Then, separately at trial, outside the jury's presence, he says, I don't believe they have any criminal history. So we have three separate statements, three separate inconsistent statements, all made by this detective under oath. And
well, that goes to the detective's credibility, doesn't it?
Right, and that's why in our issue three, we argue that the trial court erred in not timely allowing the defense to impeach Detective Fitzgerald with his prior inconsistent statement. And it's critical, the timeliness of it is critical because the record also reflects that appellant would not have testified had he been allowed to impeach Detective Fitzgerald with that prior inconsistent statement when he first requested to do so and laid the predicate. So, returning to the issue of the CIs.
Go ahead, Mr. Harrington. Before you leave that one point, I'm interested.
Yes.
How's that a thing that is established in the record? What thought processes the defendant and his counsel might have gone through had they known or had the information about the confidential informant's prior criminal convictions before they decided to testify?
Well, because, Your Honor, the defense made it quite clear and actually stated on the record that the defense counsel stated on her client's behalf on the record, I believe it's at the beginning of Volume 6 in the reporter's record, that he would not have taken the stand and testified in his own defense had they been allowed to impeach Detective Fitzgerald and had that information at the time she first requested.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. But returning to the issue of the CI's identity, there could have, and in fact, another way in which this was material and should have been disclosed and would have been helpful to a fair determination of guilt or innocence had to do with the nature of whether or not these drugs were in fact planted. As Your Honor put it, the drugs manifested themselves. And from the testimony at trial, the discord between the testimony of Detective Fitzgerald and appellant, there was a genuine contested fact issue as to whether appellant was ever in fact in possession of these drugs. And apparently this CI was the only one who had personal knowledge as to whether appellant was in fact in possession of them. And without knowing that person's identity, he could not even investigate her. It also came out in the in-camera hearing that this CI's drug of choice was methamphetamines. So it could have advanced a plausible defensive theory that she planted the drugs on him and then called in this tip to the detective.
Maybe she sold them to him.
That's something that could have also...
I mean, that's another possibility to throw out there when we're talking about speculative conduct that might have happened in terms of the informant.
It might have happened. And again, it's only required under Bowdoin that the defense seeking to force disclosure of the CI's identity make a plausible showing that the informer's identity may be important.
What if there was no informant at all? What if the police officer had gone up to Mr. Coleman and said what he says he said was, you know, what are you up to? Would you turn out your pockets? And he voluntarily turned out his pockets, and lo and behold, there are drugs. I mean, doesn't it really just come down to whether or not you're going to believe the police officer or the defendant?
I would say that's one issue. I would say in this case it doesn't all come down to that, but that is an important issue that, again, the informer's identity could have gone to had it been disclosed. And also, this raises another issue. If it is our position that Brady, because it is based on the due process requirement of the Constitution, should trump the confidential informer's privilege under Rule 508, because the Constitution takes precedence over the rules of evidence. And so even if the defendant did not meet his showing under Rule 508, he was still entitled to disclosure of this information under Brady and Michael Morton. And it is not lost on us that because the confidential informant's identity was never disclosed, and therefore appellant could not have investigated the CI and critically researched her criminal history, it is difficult for this court to make a determination, because you don't have all the facts. We don't know who the CI was, and we don't know the extent of her criminal history. But I think it's helpful. I found this case, this was not cited in our brief, but in doing research for this oral argument, I came across a state White v. State. This is a 1974 case from the Court of Criminal Appeals. The citation on it is 517 Southwest 2nd, 543.
Repeat that really fast.
Sorry, Judge. 517 Southwest 2nd, 543.
Thank you.
And basically, this case involved a situation where the police relied on a CI, and the officer who was basically the main testifying officer at trial, and in fact purchased drugs from the defendant, after the fact told his CI that he thought it was a real good idea if he left town. And he evidently sent him some money. And the issue in this case basically was whether or not appellant had been denied his right to compulsory process because he can't subpoena a witness that the state has made unavailable. Not exactly factually similar to our case, but I think it is important because the court in this case addressed the issue of the nature of the alleged suppression is such that the precise content of the evidence sought to be discovered, cannot be shown. And so, they found that that sufficient materiality had been shown because the informer did participate in the offense or was present at the time. And in this case, the informant must have had to have been present at the time or had some involvement with the offense to know that our client was in possession of methamphetamine. This is also how this case is distinguishable in one respect from Parks and Horn, two cases relied on by the state both at trial and on appeal. One, those cases were possession with intent to deliver and manufactured delivery cases. This case was just strict possession. He was charged with and convicted of possession. So the actual offense, as far as whether or not the CI was present at the scene of the offense, or present for the offense, she must have had to have been to know that he was in possession of methamphetamines. And in any event, the Court of Criminal Appeals in White concluded there is no additional requirement that the particular evidence which would be given, that is to say the testimony of the CI who appellants sought to disclose or uncover, be shown to be material or to be favorable to the defense. This is so because of the logical impossibility of showing such character of the evidence as a prerequisite to learning what the evidence is. So it's not lost on us that in this case, because the trial court never even asked the detective for the CI's identity, we don't know for sure what that CI would have said. What we do know is that if the CI's identity had been disclosed, the defense could have investigated her, they could have looked into her criminal history, they could have even called her as a witness if it turned out that she had something favorable to the defense or could have advanced one of the defensive theories sought to be advanced by appellant. Really quickly, because I see I'm just about out of time, returning to the issue of the prior inconsistent statement, it is our position that the defense laid the proper predicate, and the state, I underlined it, I won't flip through the brief right now, but made some comment that the defendant was, there was no error here because it was shown that the statements were not actually inconsistent. I dealt with that earlier in my argument. Again, you had three separate inconsistent statements made by Detective Fitzgerald. But also, as I understand the state's argument, he's saying any error was harmless because appellant was eventually allowed to impeach Detective Fitzgerald with his prior inconsistent statement. But the problem is, again, as we've argued in our brief, it was only after he'd already testified and exposed himself to cross-examination that they were allowed to do that impeachment. And so we believe that that was error on the part of the trial court, and it cannot be deemed harmless. If there are no further questions.
Mr. Arrington, I have two things, and thank you very much for your presentation. In your briefing, I recall reading, and I read this brief Monday, but I recall reading in your briefing that you cited a case, at least it's in my mind that you did, that's brought up the point that when it's the credibility of the state's main witness and the detective who talked to the informant, and that credibility is under attack, that's sufficient to raise the requirement of disclosure because it goes to the constitutional privilege on cross-examination.
Oh, yes. That was a concurring opinion by Justice Blackmun in Pennsylvania v. Ritchie.
Let me write that down.
In which he, and I'm sorry, Your Honor, I see my time is up, just to be
That's
fair.
Okay. Yes. I'm asking you questions, and I got one more.
And yes, that was basically, and he suggested in that opinion that there may well be a confrontation clause violation.
Which judge?
Justice Blackmun.
Okay. And
the confrontation clause, just to alert the court to it, that issue is preserved because she did cite to the Sixth Amendment in her motion to force disclosure of the informant, just in case you were going to ask me whether that was raised.
No, I know it was. And in terms of the relationship between the confidential informant and Officer Ferguson, Fitzgerald. He testified or made statements, at least in the record and in the brief, that it was a 20-year or 30-year relationship.
But yes, I recall that that was in the in-camera hearing and possibly also at trial. But I do remember that he said he'd known her for 20 years or so.
It's striking to me that the information given to the detective by the confidential informant that he followed up on within 10 minutes after the phone call was so detailed that the detective was told that the defendant was riding a bicycle to the scene. How can you know if the defendant is riding a bicycle to the scene if you don't have eyes on at that point?
I would say, well, I don't recall the detail about the bicycle, but you're right. Appellant was riding his bike at the scene. I would say that again, it comes back to the credibility of the detective because he typed up this probable cause affidavit after he had encountered appellant and the drugs manifested themselves. So again, whether or not he was being truthful and what the CI told him, this all comes back to things that could have been more thoroughly investigated had the CI's identity been disclosed.
How significant is it in your mind, Mr. Arrington, if it is, or what does it say to you when the trial court judge made specific findings that there wasn't a suspicion issue or a probable cause issue that might affect a ruling on the disclosure of the confidential informant, and maintained that position early in the trial and then totally switched that and gave up a part of the transcript of the confidential hearing?
I do not know what made the trial court suddenly decide to disclose the excerpts from the in-camera hearing. That's something that you don't get from a cold record, but what the record does show is that she did that the morning after defense counsel brought it to her attention that the prosecutor had made a joke about the detective planting drugs on this defendant. The prosecutor claimed it was a joke. The defense counsel did not seem to think it was that funny or at least in good taste. But that was something that happened at the very close of the previous day's proceedings, and then we come back, beginning of the next record, court releases excerpts of the
kind of an additional thing to put in the judge's mind about what her ruling was.
Perhaps. Again, not everything is evident from a pulled record.
Thank you, Mr. Arrington, for your presentation.
Thank you. Would you please add 5 minutes?
May it please the court, counsel. Chief Justice Sutter, you've hit on an important point here. This really is about the detective's credibility. There's no set of facts here where the confidential informant's credibility matters at all on a determination of guilt or innocence. You said something about what if it had been an anonymous tip? Sure, absolutely. This is actually no different in many ways from had it been an anonymous tip. And in fact, that kind of thing happens all the time. Detective Fitzgerald acts upon it, goes, sees the defendant, says, hey, what's going on? What are you doing? I heard you got a tip that you had some meth on you. Do you mind opening up your pockets? And he spit it out. That's if you believe Detective Fitzgerald, which the jury did. And so there's no set of facts on which this issue of the confidential informant matters at all. And to go even, to take it even another step, there's no Texas case, at least none that I can find, that would have this court hold what the appellant is asking the court to hold. All of the cases requiring the disclosure of a confidential informant have to do with these buy-bust kinds of situations, where the CI or whoever this person is that has knowledge actually witnessed the transaction taking place and has something to add about what actually happened with respect to the elements of the crime that the defendant in the case has been charged with. That's just non-existent here.
Well, counsel, do you recall the bicycle testimony?
Absolutely.
The defendant is riding a bicycle down to the soup kitchen and has got meth on him.
Correct.
That wasn't what the informant told the police officer according to the police officer's testimony.
Well, the informant told the police officer that he would be on a bicycle at the soup kitchen at St. Andrews, Our Daily Bread, in something like 10 minutes. I think that's exactly what she
So how intimate in terms of an own in my eyes view was doesn't that draw to your mind the question of the knowledge of the informant about the activities and conduct of the defendant whenever it is so particular and so tight in a time frame, and then it all plays out according to exactly like what the detective said. 10 minutes after he hung up the phone, he went over and saw the defendant riding his bicycle and parking it and walking over towards a van.
Well, I think that's likely why the jury found it so credible in the first place. And the drugs were found. The confidential informant, Chief Justice Sutherland made another good point. The confidential informant could be the biggest scum of the earth. We don't know I don't know who this person is. Could be the least credible person on the planet. Could be a known pathological liar. But in this case, it wouldn't matter to a determination of guilt or innocence.
Well, it would matter now, counsel. If the confidential informant doesn't have some degree of reliability, then the police officer would not be entitled to rely upon the confidential informant and take action in terms of police investigation.
Of course the officer would. If it could have been an anonymous tip, he could have done the same thing that he did here. And it was a consensual encounter. He made no stop. So there's no issue of needing reasonable suspicion or probable cause or anything like that, like we arguably could have in a situation like you're talking about.
Well, I understand that that was the trial court's ruling, and I understand our burden in terms of analysis on rulings made by the trial court in that respect. But what I am concerned about is when you couple these instant observation tied to short time contact and the dispute about the possession of the methamphetamines, that all comes back to me to the point that is made by counsel for defense, and that is that this is a matter of credibility of the police officer. Do you agree that that's what this case is all about?
I do agree that the credibility of the police officer is important in this case, and the jury resolved that in the police officer's favor.
And what is your addressing the issues that I asked counsel about in the case of Penn against Ritchie, where there is a statement that the credibility of the police officer may come into such prominence in the trial that it rises to the level of constitutionally protected right of confrontation and the Brady rules?
Well, first of all, that case is a concurring opinion. It's not binding authority, and there's no Texas case that's followed that in this context. So I want to point that out. But second of all, what I would point out is that the officer's credibility in this case is wholly separate from the CI's credibility. The two are not intertwined, as the appellant would have us believe. The officer's credibility here, as the appellant has raised it, has to do with what the appellant claims are inconsistent statements that he made first at the in-camera hearing, which the judge held out of an abundance of caution and didn't even need to hold. But statements that he made there and then made during trial that the appellant claims are inconsistent, we claim were not inconsistent. At most, they were a misunderstanding or an inartful reply, because here's what really happened. During the in-camera hearing, the trial court judge asked Detective Fitzgerald, do you know about criminal history? He says, no, none that I know of. I know that she, since the arrest, the appellant's arrest here, that he told the trial court, she's been arrested on another charge. I'm not exactly sure what that charge is. It's narcotics. And I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist of it. And he says, and I wrote a letter on her behalf to the DA's office in that case, that specific case that occurred after the arrest in this case. The trial court, when it issued its ruling, 508 ruling, sent an email to the parties. That email said only CI has had criminal cases from time to time, I think is what she wrote. At trial, Detective Fitzgerald was asked, on cross-examination, what do you know about criminal history? Oh, I'm not aware of any. Oh, wait, no, I do know that she's has a recent arrest. There was never any inconsistency, and when he came back on to get it clarified later, he said, I lied. It wasn't intentional. She does have that arrest that happened after here, but it was all cleared up before the jury. I take issue with the appellant's characterization of what happened with that all of that testimony. First of all, in that it wasn't a material inconsistency, but also that the appellant had ample opportunity to cross-examine Detective Fitzgerald on credibility issues with respect to his credibility, and did in fact do so. Some of those things covered issues with respect to the confidential informant. You had asked the question, Justice Meyer, why did the trial court go and change its mind later about and let him get into those other questions? Again, as Mr. Arrington points out, it's hard to get a total feel for it from the cold record. I think the trial court was getting exasperated with the defense continually pushing this 508 issue and essentially trying to ignore that ruling and keep getting this confidential informant information that wasn't relevant. The trial court, after it came out that one of our prosecutors had made a joke during some inspection of the evidence that was perhaps in poor taste, she then opened up to, out of an abundance of caution, I think, to make sure this is what, let's get it all out in the open, let's get it all, you know, make sure that everybody knows what's going on. But the defense had ample opportunity to cover those issues and did in fact do so. And the issue of Detective Fitzgerald's credibility is in no way related to the confidential informants, because the confidential informant would have absolutely nothing to add to a determination of guilt innocence.
Let me ask you this question a little bit off the subject, well, quite a bit off the subject. The jury argument, the improper jury argument allegation, that does give me some concern. And you seem to, it appears that it is improper jury argument. And you hang your hat on the argument that it was waived because they didn't lodge the proper objection. And I've looked at it up one side and down the other, and I'm asking myself, what is the proper objection?
Well, the proper objection would have been that it was improper jury argument to set forth that he was guilty of another crime and ought to be punished of another crime. That would have been the proper objection.
Well, isn't that facts which are not in evidence? And that's the objection they lodged.
Well, again, that's why I put that argument in my brief, saying arguably this is a situation that the court should look at when resolving this issue.
But you do agree it's an improper argument, don't you?
Not necessarily, and I'll tell you why. It was pretty inartfully worded. I will grant that. But when you read it in...
Not once, but twice, because it got interrupted and did it again. So inartful or deliberate is a real question, but as I recall the transcript, they made that argument, there was an objection, that there was banter back and forth between the judge and the attorney lodging the objection about whether it was a proper objection or what, and then another objection was interposed, and then it was restated again in full by the prosecutors. It seems quite deliberate.
Yes, it was stated twice.
Mm-hmm.
If you read all of the comments in context, what I take from it is that it is a... Remember, the jury has already convicted the appellant at this point, determined that in their credibility determination, they believe Detective Fitzgerald...
And therefore the defendant lied?
And therefore the defendant lied. And so what the argument, if you read it from, and this is... I believe the proper reading of it, that in the larger context of what the prosecutor said, he's saying the defendant did not get up here and tell you the truth, and that is something that you can take into consideration when assessing punishment.
Well, what about perjury? Can they take that into consideration?
No, I would agree that if you construe this argument that way, that would probably be an improper.
He actually uses perjury twice.
Improper argument, but what I'm saying is I think that in the larger context of the reading, it is a better reading of it that he's saying that the appellant was a liar. And also, he does mention, look, we're not charging him with this.
But it is perjury, by the way, right? He tells the jury that. It is perjury.
Actually,
I believe he even talked about the punishment that he could be imposed. Yeah,
yes.
If I'm remembering that.
I would point out also with respect to harm.
And those are facts outside the record, aren't they?
Yes.
Okay. Are. Go ahead. Sorry.
I would point out with respect to harm on this argument that the appellant had many, many drug arrests and other pen trips prior, that it is a fact. I think if you're a juror in this case and you've already found him guilty, you've made the determination that he was lying to you. It is, and so it is a fact that you could take as a punishment juror that he was a liar. And combined with those things, that the sentence in this case was appropriate and in line with what would have happened, regardless of the prosecutor's comment there. With respect to, I do want to point out the appellant brought your attention
counsel,
to
counsel, let me get it clear in my mind what actually was presented in terms of evidence of prior convictions.
All of the prior, he had several prior pen trips. There were some pen packets, his criminal history.
And all that was put in front of the jury?
Yes. Yes, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
I do want to point out the White case that counsel brought to your attention that is not in the briefing in this case, and just point out that it's distinguishable. It really has, again, no, can't be applied to the facts in this case. It appears to be, I think, a by-bus case, and the facts in that were the officer basically told the witness, go away, get lost while we try this case. That witness actually witnessed the offense occurring, and so, of course, had something to add to a determination of guilt innocence in that case. Do want to make sure I've addressed all the courts.
Mr. Whitten.
Yes.
Do you agree with the defense counsel's contention that the crux of this case was the credibility of Officer Fitzgerald?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. Because the jury, as we know, only had his testimony to go on, other than the corroboration of the fact of what the CI told him and what he said the CI had. But yes, they needed to believe Detective Fitzgerald if they were going to convict him.
Thank you, sir.
If there are no further questions, I will yield my time to the court. Thank the court for having us here.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. We disagree with the state that there's no set of facts on which the confidential informant's identity matters. I hope I'm quoting him correctly. There, I wrote it down. And obviously, we further especially disagree that the confidential informant's testimony would have contributed absolutely nothing to the determination of guilt, innocence. This case did ultimately boil down to credibility. I mean, there was one issue for the jury to decide. Did the defendant, Mr. Coleman, knowingly possess the specified quantity of methamphetamines? The CI's identity would have enabled him, knowing that identity, would have enabled them to investigate the CI, find out her criminal history, and even call her as a witness if it turned out that she said something different than what Detective Fitzgerald testified he told her. And the greater issue here is, as we all know, due process guarantees every criminal defendant the right to meaningfully present a complete defense. As the Supreme Court said in Washington v. Texas, the right to offer the testimony of witnesses and to compel their attendance if necessary is, in plain terms, the right to present a defense, the right to present the defendant's version of the facts as well as the prosecution's to the jury so it may decide where the truth lies.
If we accept your position in this,
yes,
we are basically holding that, at least in the counties in the Second Court of Appeals District, that every time there's a confidential informant, all that information is going to have to be turned over to the defense, aren't we?
If the defendant makes the necessary showing under Brady or Michael Morton, yes.
Well, what did you show? You just said if we knew more about this confidential informant, we might know motivation or proclivity to lie or whatever. That can be said about any confidential informant. So how are we not opening up the whole shebang anytime there's a confidential informant in all circumstances?
What I would say is that, and well, my answer to that is twofold. One is that the record is developed in this case to where it would show that there was at least enough known about the confidential informant to know that she had a criminal history. That may not be the case in every case. And this is where I also take issue with the state's contention that the credibility of Detective Fitzgerald and the credibility of the CI are wholly separate. It's not that they're entirely separate, because it would matter if this a person was the scum of the earth, as I think he said, because whether or not the detective was relying on this informant and could have given the jury reason to doubt his credibility and his judgment. So it does go to the detective's credibility. Second, because I did say my answer was twofold, you have hit on precisely the nature of the problem, and this was why we brought up the White case, that occurs when the confidential informant's identity is not known. Because since we have nothing in the record identifying the confidential informant by name, nothing, I can't really say more specifically how this would have been helpful. But again, under White, and this was what I was trying to find earlier, but if the court will forgive my clumsiness, I had it highlighted right here. The Court of Criminal Appeals said, where the evidence is by necessity yet to be developed, it is sufficient to show the material character of the witness. Once this is done, the state may not obstruct the pursuit of it by the defense, either by refusing to reveal the identity or by spiriting the witness away. And yes, there are certain factual distinctions you could make between this case and White, but again, in this case, defense met its showing to show the materiality of the witness. She had knowledge of pertinent facts and could have gone to Detective Fitzgerald's credibility, among other things. And I'll just close with this quote from Roviaro, because that is the seminal case on this issue of confidential informant privilege, that defendant's opportunity to cross-examine the law enforcement officers was hardly a substitute for an opportunity to examine the informer himself or herself. And that's why, again, it doesn't matter that Mr. Coleman had ample opportunity, as the state put it, to cross-examine Detective Fitzgerald at trial. He was denied his opportunity to meaningfully present a complete defense by the trial court's failure to order disclosure of the confidential informant's identity. Without that knowledge, he couldn't investigate her. He couldn't determine whether or not her version of facts differed from Detective Fitzgerald's version of facts. He couldn't look into her criminal history. And finally, we would ask that, because this is an issue of first impression, that that this opinion be ordered published. Thank you. If there are no further questions, then we request reversal.
Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you for your argument today. It's been very helpful to the court. Your case has now been submitted.